Yeah, this is Laz Izada in South Florida with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. All right.
This is Courtney Darrow with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy out of Asheville.
This is Lisa Logeman in Raleigh with EDF.
This is Rhonda Ruff from Save It Now Glades in Clewiston.
Rachel Grillo with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I'm the development director here.
And this is Giselle Chilon with Exponent in the D.C. area.
This is Carolyn Chabaley, Conservation Voters of South Carolina. I'm in Florence, South Carolina.
All right. Well, we may well have more people jumping in and joining us as we go along here, but I think we're going to go ahead and get started since everybody's time is important and we've got a bit to talk about here. So, again, I just wanted to welcome you. My name is Jennifer Rennick, and I'm the Federal Policy Director here with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I'm going to turn us now here to slide two, which is where Colin has us here. This is, as Colin mentioned, this is our election results webinar for what we've just seen happen here with the national elections here over the last couple of weeks. And then as we advance to slide three, I just want to welcome you and tell you just a little bit about the two organizations that are hosting this. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, which we are all, several of us are employees of, has been working here throughout the Southeast for over 20 years. We are working in a variety of program areas, and all of our work is focused on seeking global warming solutions. And as I said, we have been around for more than 20 years. We were formally incorporated in 1985, and we are now spread across five states with offices and members, supporters, and staff in all of our southeastern states. And our work to preserve, restore, and protect our environment and our communities is done through supporting innovative technology. We do education, outreach, and advocacy. So that is the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And then if you advance to slide four, I wanted to tell you a little bit about the SACE Action Fund. The SACE Action Fund is a sister organization, and it's the political arm of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And the Action Fund is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that is working to make global warming solutions a priority for our elected leaders. So both of our organizations have a very similar goal. We also engage in public education and outreach through the Action Fund, and we also do it in some more direct ways with a scorecard, with clean energy candidate endorsements. This year in the 2008 election cycle, we actually had a Dirty Dozen list for the Southern Dirty Dozens. And you can look at both of these organizations on the web. The Action Fund website is cleanenergyactionfund.org. And Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is cleanenergy.org. So I just wanted to give you a little background there about who we are as we get started. And now I will turn it over to Colin. He's going to give us a little bit of an election wrap-up.
Great. Thank you, Jen. Okay, so we're all basically familiar with the outcome of this presidential election. We know that we now have a president-elect Obama who will be taking office on January the 20th. We wanted to just point out kind of the margin of victory and provide this map that shows exactly which states went red and which states went blue. So you can see on the slide that President-elect Obama received 365 electoral votes, taking 29 states and the District of Columbia. Senator McCain took 162 electoral votes, taking 21 states. And we're still counting in Missouri. It's leaning towards McCain, but it's still being decided. Obviously, the outcome of that particular race will not substantially change anything save the margin of victory and just the numbers relating to the popular vote and the electoral votes. We will still have a president-elect Obama. We're all basically familiar with this type of a map, this red and blue map. You've probably seen something like this on the news or in other media outlets. And as we move to slide six, I just want to point out this different sort of a map that is less familiar to many of us. And this is a map that is based specifically on the population. And so the proportions of each state's population, as opposed to the last map, which of course is based proportional to each state's physical size, its total land mass or its total acreage. And so what we see with this map is that the sizes of the states begin to shift a little bit when you account for the population. And so obviously states like Texas and California are still rather large. You notice up in the Northeast that many of the states increase in size due to their population densities. Western states and states in the Pacific Northwest began to shrink a little bit due to their sort of lack of population density. And then what we see in the Southeast is that it's actually a little bit difficult to tell. It looks like there's actually a net increase in terms of, you know, the way each state is sized proportional to the population. It looks like South Carolina, North Carolina, and Tennessee decrease a little bit, but that quote-unquote loss is made up for by increases in Georgia and Florida, which seem to have grown a little bit in the population. We see here that Obama took over 66 million of the popular votes, and Senator McCain took just under 60 million of the popular votes. So moving on to slide 7, we see this purple map, and this is something that analysts are beginning to look at, which breaks down the blue and red states into the counties, which are then labeled according to which candidate won in that county. And so nationally, we see pockets of bright red or bright blue, and we see that stark difference. But we also see a lot of the bipartisan purple spread throughout the nation. In the Southeast, we also see smaller pockets of that dark red or that starkly contrasted red and then that blue, but we also see mostly this bipartisan purple color. And, this is also a map that people are less familiar with, but I think it really goes to show just what kind of a bipartisan region that we're dealing with in the Southeast. So as we move over to slide 8, I want to talk a little bit about the specific differences in the Senate. So in the 110th Congress, we know that the Senate was essentially broken up into 51 Democrats and 49 Republicans in those caucuses, depending on exactly which way Mr. Lieberman decided to vote that day. Now the Democrats have picked up about 6 seats in this election, including 2 in the Southeast. One is Kay Hagan in North Carolina, who took the seat from Senator Elizabeth Dole. The other is Mark Warner in Virginia, who took the seat from John Warner. So that leaves the Republicans now with 40 seats. They didn't pick up any new seats in the Southeast. In fact, we have we're still counting in Minnesota and Alaska, and then in Georgia, specific to the Southeast, we are headed into a runoff between incumbent Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss and his Democratic opponent Jim Martin, who's an attorney from the Atlanta region. Right now, the polls show Chambliss with about 49.8 and his challenger, Mr. Martin, at 46.8. A Libertarian candidate, Alan Buckley, is drawing down about 3.4% of the vote there in Georgia. The Senate, and you can see that map that shows exactly some of the changes that took place in the Senate. So, and just to be clear, that Georgia runoff will only be a runoff between 2 candidates, the Republican Saxby Chambliss and then his challenger, Jim Martin. And that's scheduled for December the 2nd. So it's coming up. All eyes are on the Georgia runoff. And at Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, we're monitoring that runoff particularly closely. So moving on to the House of Representatives. You know, in the last congressional session, or the one that's just drawing to a close, the Democrats had 236 members in the House, and the Republicans had 199 members in the House. The Democrats have picked up a number of seats in the Southeast. They picked up about six, and then the Republicans picked up one seat in Florida. Tim Rooney took a seat from incumbent Tim Mahoney. And that leaves now the spread at 255 Democrats and 175 Republicans making up the House of Representatives. And I just wanted to point out that in the Southeast, the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy Action Fund that Jen mentioned at the start of the presentation actually endorsed Cosmas, Grayson, and Kissley. I'm sorry, and Kissel. Who all took seats here in the Southeast. So there are three races still being counted. Those are in California, Ohio, and Virginia, and then two runoffs in Louisiana are slated for December. So as we head now to slide 10, I believe, we're ready for Jen, who will take us through the specific delegations from each state.
All right, thank you, Colin. And one thing I wanted to point out here is, you know, as we look at the House as a whole, the Democrats have definitely picked up about 20 seats and a few races still be decided. And this 2008 election has created a House of Representatives that is decidedly more Democratic. It is a more liberal House of Representatives, and it will be missing several long-serving Republicans who lost their seats either to challenges or some of whom stepped down through to retirement. And so, you know, there some of the more moderate Republican lawmakers will not be joining the 111th Congress, and that is going to make the House of Representatives probably look a little more starkly contrasted between the more conservative side and the more liberal side. And so we will be watching with interest to see how that plays out. I'm going to fairly quickly go through the slides of the states here in the Southeast. Some of our slides, like Alabama here on slide 10, has an asterisk because I want to point out that Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy Action Fund primarily focuses on five states. And so the other five states that are included in this presentation for some of the members and allies that may be on this call are not priority states and therefore not states where we have typically focused, but we would be happy to try and answer questions as we go through these as well. Just wanted to point out in Alabama, there was one change in party seat, and that is where Montgomery Mayor Bobby Bright, he narrowly won a race. It was literally 50%, 50%. The margin was only a few hundred votes, and so that has turned one seat in Alabama from Republican to Democrat. And then as we move to the next slide, slide 11 in Florida, this is a state where SACE has done a lot of work with our allies in recent years. We did have three change in party seats here in Florida. In Florida's 8th district, Alan Grayson defeated the incumbent Rick Keller by 52-48%. That was actually one of the more closely watched races. And then there was also another pickup in Florida, also in Central Florida, where Suzanne Cosmas, who formerly served in Florida's House of Representatives, defeated the incumbent Congressman Tom Fainey, and that was a sizable pickup. That was 57% to 41%. So there were two very significant shifts there in the mid-section of Florida. And then the only pickup that the Republicans earned in the southeastern United States was where the challenger, Tom Rooney, easily picked this seat up against the one-term incumbent, Tim Mahoney, in the 16th district. That was a 60-40% vote spread, so that was a fairly sizable victory. That was a race where the incumbent had admitted adultery in the weeks before. So it was a closely watched race at many levels and resulted in a net gain of one seat for the Democrats in the Florida delegation. And there were a couple of other close races I just wanted to point out. In South Florida, the two Diaz-Balart brothers faced some pretty stiff competition. And both of them retained their seats, but it definitely shows there are some changing dynamics happening there in Florida. As we go to slide 12, I'll point out in Georgia, there were no changes in Georgia's House delegation. Everyone was returned, but as Colin pointed out earlier, the Senate race is still undecided, a very close race, and according to state law, it required a runoff because no one broke the 50% vote margin. And that runoff is, as many of you are probably aware, already gaining national attention because depending on the outcome of both the Minnesota and the Alaska race, Georgia's seat could possibly become the 60th Democratic seat that would provide a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And a filibuster is where a member of either party can hold the floor as long as they choose and refuse to allow a vote. So if you have 60 votes, you can usually stop any form of vote delay. So this is going to be a very important watched race on December 2nd. So we urge you to stay tuned, and if you're in Georgia, don't forget to go vote. As we go to slide 13, next couple of slides are states that are non-priority safe states. Again, there were no change of party seats in Kentucky, but it's worth pointing out that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell narrowly won a fifth term. He had a very strong challenge there from a Democratic businessman, Bruce Lunsford, and won 52-48%. And then as we go to slide 14 with the Mississippi delegation, both Mississippi Senate races seats were actually in play. It was kind of unusual. Senate Cochran's was a regularly scheduled race, and Senator Wicker had been appointed by the governor in January of this year to fill a seat vacated by the former Senator Trent Lott. And so Wicker was sitting for the first time for a Senate seat. Neither challenger was successful. Both incumbents retained their seats on the Senate side. But there was a change in a House seat earlier this year. It's a little unusual here. I just wanted to point out Democrat Travis Childers defeated Republican Greg Davis in a special election in May to fill an open seat, and that was a heavily Republican district. That was an upset there in May, and then both of them faced off again in the general election rematch, and Childers was once again successful. So it definitely shows a little bit of a changing dynamics there in Mississippi. As we go to slide 15, the North Carolina delegation saw two changes, and Colin has already indicated both of those. The Senate race definitely drew national attention because a North Carolina state senator defeated a first-term incumbent senator by a pretty wide margin, 53-42%. And in another closely watched North Carolina race that actually did get a little bit of national attention as well, the Democratic challenger Larry Kissel beat the incumbent, the six-term incumbent Robin Hayes, 55-45%. And it should be noted that in the 2006 election cycle, Kissel also challenged Hayes, and that was a difference of 329 votes. It was the closest narrow margin of defeat or victory in 2006, and then in 2008 it was a 10% margin. So that definitely showed some fairly significant dynamics there at play in North Carolina's 8th district. As we go to slide 16, there were absolutely no seat changes. There were two congressmen who faced stronger challenges than what they've seen in the past. Fourth-term Congressman Henry Brown in the 1st District faced a challenger from Linda Kettner, and he narrowly won that 52-48%. That was a fairly strong challenge. And then also Congressman Joe Wilson held on to his seat as well. He defeated a challenger, Rob Miller, who's a former Marine captain who was running to replace him, and that was also a fairly narrow margin of 54-46%. And Senator Graham was reelected and returned to Congress, to the Senate for South Carolina. Slide 17, we're almost done here. Tennessee delegation, there were absolutely no close races in Tennessee. No seats changed. Senator Alexander was reelected to a second term. But the one minor change is that Tennessee's first district is now represented by the Johnson City Mayor, Dr. Phil Rowe. He defeated the incumbent Congressman David Davis in the August primary. So the seat stayed comfortably in Republican hands by a 72% vote margin, but there will be a new congressman from Tennessee in the delegation in January. And finally, in Virginia, on slide 18, there was a lot of change in Virginia this time. Senator-elect Warner is taking the seat from the current Senator Warner. There is no relation. Mark Warner will succeed John Warner. And that was a fairly sizable victory that flipped a seat from Republican to Democrat. There were also a couple of surprise House seat changes, where Glenn Nye defeated the incumbent Thelma Drake in the 2nd District, which is a coastal area there in the coastal plain. There was an open seat in Virginia's 11th District, and that's up in the sort of the D.C. metro area. And in that one, the Democratic challenger defeated the Republican challenger. It was an open seat vacated. And then there is one of those votes race is still being counted in the 5th District. There is a 700-vote margin right now, and so that will likely go to a recount. So we may not know about Virginia's 5th District for potentially several weeks or even a month or two to come. So that is the overview, the very quick state-by-state breakdown. And as you go to slide 19, you can see, once again, we've got 255 Democratic seats. We've got 180 Republican seats, and the breakdowns are 44 in the Southeast and 49 in the Southeast. That shows a fairly close margin there. And then when you look in the Senate, there are 4 Democrats in the Senate in the Southeast and 13 Republicans, and both of those numbers represent that there is still one House race to be decided and one Senate race to be decided. So that is the overview, the postmortem, if you will, on the election itself. And now we just want to take the last couple minutes of this to give you a very brief overview of what we're going to look at here as we go into the 111th Congress and as we go into the new administration. So Colin's going to do the next couple of slides, and then I'll finish it off.
Sure. Thanks, Jen. And as she mentioned, we're just going to take a few minutes here with still plenty of time left over after the webinar for questions, to describe some of the processes that are taking place as returning members of Congress and senators and new members of Congress and senators begin to prepare for the 111th Congress. First, I want to mention that many of you may have heard that Speaker Pelosi is now calling for what they call, a lame duck congressional session here during the month of December. So it's, I think it's still a little bit unclear as to whether or not that will ultimately take place, but she is calling for a lame duck session for members to return to Congress in order to pass a bailout for the automakers. Not exactly sure what that would look like, but there are many in the environmental community and many who are keeping an eye on how this will transpire and whether or not that will include any strings or any types of provisions for emission standards or efficiency or alternative forms of transportation. But if Speaker Pelosi does convene a lame duck session, then it will be with a goal to provide support for the automakers, and we'll be keeping a close eye on that just to make sure exactly whether or not we will see any kind of support for clean energy or what happens there. But other than that, there are a number of kind of just general administrative tasks that that both chambers of Congress will undertake between now and January and the beginning of the 111th Congress. And these include general recurring duties such as electing their leadership, appointing committee chairs, and things like that. And we don't expect many of the leadership we expect to stay the same. Many of the committee chairs and minority leaders and other leadership positions we to stay the same as well. except we do want to highlight a potential change in the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee. Many of you have probably been following this, that we have recently heard Representative Henry Waxman has now said he's going to challenge Representative Dingell for chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee. This is an important post when it comes to climate and energy legislation. As you all know, many of the bills that we're tracking ultimately go through this committee. So both Mr. Waxman and Mr. Dingell have formed whip teams to begin to shore up their support and turn out the votes in support of each of them, and we will be keeping a close eye to see who will ultimately be the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee in the 111th Congress. As you know, in the last session, the House convened a select committee on energy independence and global warming, and we expect that without any drastic changes in the leadership, that committee would be reinstated. Something else that was unique that we saw in the 110th Congress was that many of the caucuses convened task forces on energy and climate policy, specifically the Blue Dogs, many of whom are from the Southeast, and members of the Congressional Black Caucus, both convened task forces to look at different policies and begin to hone some of their principles on energy and climate policy. That, I think, signaled a very clear interest by both of these important caucuses in energy and climate issues. And I think that even though some of the chairs of these caucuses are changing hands, I think we expect them to maintain their interest in these issues and to even reconvene their caucuses, their caucus task forces in the next Congress. There are a number of kind of agenda items that we expect the Congress to take to undertake in the next session, and some of these will probably happen within the first 100 days. Some of these will happen probably, you know, in a longer time frame. But as we look at slide 21 here, we can see that there are a number of items that we expect Congress to undertake. First is that Congress will have an opportunity, or the House of Representatives will have an opportunity, per the Congressional Review Act, to go back and look at a number of regulatory changes that were made within the last 60 days of President Bush's administration. We expect that members of the House of Representatives, especially in the leadership, will be going through those regulatory changes with a fine-tooth comb to see if there's anything that they can amend or overturn. And their ability to do this period of review has, I think it's a 60-day window, or it's a pretty short window of time that the House will have to go back and review these regulatory changes. We expect them to coordinate with President-elect Obama's administration in setting the pace for new climate legislation. And then, of course, many members of the House and Senate will likely reintroduce their climate bills, maybe with some changes based on what they've learned after Lieberman-Warner and in the policy debates that occurred in the last part of the 110th session. We expect a renewable energy standard to pick up some steam with President-elect Obama's leadership. We know that the renewable energy standard actually has already passed the House of Representatives as part of the negotiations in the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, and even as part of some of the negotiations that were taking place with regard to Speaker Pelosi's comprehensive compromise energy bill that was being negotiated a few months ago in September. So this is probably something that will occur on a longer time frame. I don't think we expect an RES to come through in the first 100 days, but this is something that will probably be packaged along with many other economic stimulus bills, and that we, of course, hope will include support for clean energy infrastructure and new green jobs. But we do expect that this will all be packaged as part of new legislation to shore up the United States economy. And then something that we haven't heard a lot about, but that we'll be keeping a close eye on, is the opportunity that the new Congress will have to consider reinstating the offshore drilling moratoriums. These are typically attached as a rider to omnibus spending bills, which are usually negotiated towards the end of each Congress. And as we all know, it was not reinstated a few months ago. So now there's been a lapse in the offshore drilling moratorium, but there's precedence for that, and that has happened before it was ultimately reinstated. In January and in the months following, the Congress, which Jen described now as being a much more liberal body, will have an opportunity to consider reinstating the moratoriums for offshore drilling either on an annual basis or maybe even on a longer timeline. We have no idea what's going to happen there, and I don't really have any sense of whether or not that's likely to happen, but we'll be keeping a close eye on that. And now as we head over to slide 22, Jen will talk a little bit about the president-elect's transition and agenda.
All right, thank you. And, so just to wrap up here, you know, as we see, Congress is going to go through a bit of a transition and clearly has a set of agenda that they are going to work through. The president-elect's transition, of course, much more significant, and given that the Democrats control both the White House and now both chambers of Congress, it will be significantly easier for proponents of progressive climate and energy legislation to move their agendas in the next couple of years. And during this key transition time, the two big factors are what many of you are hearing about on a day-to-day basis now, you know, who are the key personnel decisions that are being made, who is being put in for key positions. We do know that former head of the EPA, Carol Browner, has been appointed to one of these transition committees here to help look at filling all of these positions. And many of these positions are being batted around now. And then the second key thing happening during this transition time is, Senator and President-elect Obama now needs to look at translating his campaign promises into a plan of action, into his agenda. And so it'll be very, very key who he appoints to these positions and what that means. There are two bullets down there with a question mark, Climate Czar and Energy Security Council. Those are things we are being heard about. We do not know if he will appoint a climate czar. We do not know if a special energy security council will be appointed, but we are tracking those and we'll keep our members and allies informed. So finally, as we go to our last slide here, slide 23, what will some of these campaign promises look like as he begins to set an agenda? We believe one of the first agenda items is going to be to give EPA a clear signal that the Environmental Protection Agency should implement a significant decision that was handed down by the Supreme Court, Massachusetts versus EPA, which clearly said that carbon dioxide as a pollutant should be regulated and should come under administrative law. So the Bush administration punted on that and did not take responsibility for implementing that, and they said that they would do some rulemaking and deciding, and that would be handed off to the next administration. So we do expect that President-elect Obama will look into that. We also believe that early on he will look to implement a renewable energy standard, as Colin just mentioned. That is a high priority, we believe, of President-elect. Can somebody please mute their phone? There is terrible feedback right now. R6. Thank you. The renewable energy standard is something that is supported both by the Congress and by the President-elect, and we believe it's going to be a really important thing as it's tied into economic stimulus. And 28 states plus the District of Columbia currently have renewable energy standards, so this is definitely not something pie in the sky out there. But very few here in the Southeast, as many of you probably know. Only North Carolina in the Southeast has renewable energy standard. Florida is in negotiations, and so there may well be one in Florida before too long. And finally, we strongly believe the president-elect is going to work with Congress to pass climate legislation. We do not believe that that's going to be something, of course, that happens in the first 100 days. There is a sagging economy and a two-front war that needs to be looked at. But we do believe that within his first administration and probably within the first 2 years, significant work will be made towards passing comprehensive climate legislation. So with that, I will end our slideshow here. Slide 24 is just our final slide with our contact information. And we really thank and appreciate all of you for joining us today. I'd like to open it now for questions. And what I would like to do is, you know, if you want to unmute yourself to ask a question, if you can just tell us your name and again, who you're with as you ask your question, we'll be happy to try and answer it or open it to the whole group to answer. And then if people want to stay on for a few minutes beyond questions, we can certainly have an open discussion. So do we have anyone who'd like to ask a first question?
I do, Jennifer.
Yeah.
This is Carolyn Jabaley with Conservation Voters. And in light of the continued economic crisis and downturn, where political leaders will likely be fairly reluctant to do anything that will further burden commerce and industry, how will that change our not only our message but our packaging of a climate energy bill and clean energy bill?
Thank you, Carolyn. That's a great question, and it's definitely something that we've been hearing about for several months now. I mean, ever since things began to really slide in September. I believe, and Colin, you feel free to jump in here as well, I believe that how we're going to see any packaging and any movement of climate and energy legislation is clearly going to come very clearly structured as economic stimulus. We may not even be calling things climate or global warming legislation anymore. It may be about energy security. It may be about green jobs and stimulating a green economy. There was a wonderful op-ed written by Vice President Al Gore back in mid-September, and he said, why don't we have a green bail-in? You know, why are we talking about bailing out the financial sector? Why aren't we bailing in, you know, the green economy, green-collar jobs, and workers and citizens that are actually going to be, you know, continuing to feed back into our economy? And so I think any movement that happens in the waning days of this Congress, which is probably very little, but then certainly as the 111th hits the ground, I think it's going to be all about how you phrase it from an economic standpoint and from a national security standpoint. I mean, you know, when you're sending $700 billion a year overseas to purchase foreign oil, you can't say that that is a good national security plan by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, we have heartburn over a $700 billion blank check to Wall Street, but we are writing a $700 billion check every year. And that does not include, of course, uranium or coal or other imports. That's oil. So that's how I believe we're going to see this framed, and that's what I'm hearing, certainly through the allies that we work with in D.C. and through Chatless. So for us doing the work here in the field, I would, you know, urge us to take a page out of those books and be mindful of how we present things. It's not, it's going to hurt, but we got to do it. I don't think that message is going to sell well for the next 3 to 6 to 12 months. I think how we want to phrase it is, this is the right thing. We're saving energy and we're saving our economy. We're saving money. We're protecting our security. It's simply the right thing to do at every level, rather than have it be the virtuous right thing to do to save polar bears. Any other thoughts on that or a follow-up question?
Hi, this is Casey in New Orleans with the Gulf Restoration Network. Is the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy supporting Barack Obama to go to Poznan?
That's a great question. We are actually involved with a large national climate campaign called the One Sky Initiative, which is onesky.org online. And next Tuesday, there are going to be actions all over the United States where people are going to welcome the new Congress and welcome the new president and remind them of some of these top priorities in terms of greening our economy, reducing carbon emissions, you know, getting us on the right track. Part of that welcome is also going to be a direct request that while the president-elect himself may not attend, that delegation members go in order to put the United States back on the international negotiation scene. We have been missing in action entirely for 8 years now, refusing to engage in international dialogue. We certainly cannot expect other people to do the work that we are not leading in as well. And so there is a clear thought of encouraging that. So, I mean, yes, SACE, as part of our national partners, are encouraging that the United States is represented there. I don't believe that will be Barack Obama himself.
Jen, this is Tony. I'd like to add to that.
Sure.
The Southeast Coastal Climate Network, Casey, that Casey and probably many of you on this call are part of, we're in the process of drafting a sign-on letter to urge Barack Obama to go to these climate talks in Poland. So I'll get that out as a draft next week, Casey.
Yeah, thank you for chiming in on that. And, yeah, I mean, we would love to see the president-elect himself go. I don't know that that's going to happen, but at the very least, you know, we clearly need to see the United States represented there and show that we are ready to reengage and to take a leadership on the international scene here. Are there any other questions? Does anybody have any comments or concerns as we move forward here?
This is Allison Higgins down in the Florida Keys with Green Living Energy Education. And we had also heard of another kind of urging movement for the 111th Congress that's being put together through EECLE and climate communities, specifically called the Blueprint for Change. And they are trying to get local elected officials to sign on personally to this. They're looking for like 200 signatures or, you know, something pretty small like that, to send that up as well, showing that the local governments really are requesting this as well. So if anybody wanted to check that out, it's Climate Communities, and you can also find it under EECLE.
There's also another, you may have heard of the President's Climate Action Project, which is being spearheaded by some groups in Colorado, but they're putting out a national call to groups to sign on to a letter that spells out, you know, a kind of policy proposal of a number of different initiatives that they would like to see President-elect Obama initiate during his first term. And those are wide-ranging but very specific to energy and climate issues. Something you might want to check out as well. I think they're accepting signatures from individuals and organizations as well. And they actually just recently held a Hill briefing in D.C., so they seem to be gaining some momentum as well.
And one thing I wanted to add here, while the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy has not put together a sign-on letter urging the administration, the incoming administration, we do have a statement of principles on climate change on our website that can be found from the homepage under hot link, sign our climate principles. And it is not urging endorsement or support of any one particular bill, because, of course, we are in the waning days of the Congress, and all bills that were introduced in this Congress will expire when the Congress adjourns at the end of this year. But our statement of principles on climate change mirrors many of our allies out there, including One Sky, who are calling for some basic principles, you know, a statement of principles. So we are gathering signatures. We are well over 400 signatures now from our region. We're hoping to gather many more, and then we will be using those signatures and names broken out by state and then also aggregated for our whole region as we begin to do Hill visits again in January, February, March. We intend to go up a number of times, meet with new members of Congress, and also meet with current members of Congress to, you know, simply say this is the direction we need to go. This is nonpartisan, and this is the aspirational goals that we need to achieve. This is what science says we need. So if you have yet to go online and sign on to our statement of principles, I would urge you to do that, and we will be, you know, collecting those names still for a couple more months to come. Any other questions here before we wrap up?
This is Joe from Fuse. In light of our recent conversation just now of the whatever climate energy policy really being framed within the context of an economic policy, to what degree are we as states, members, and allies engaging with Green for All on some of their work, in particular their next campaign push, which is going to be to really promote a clean energy core within the first 100 days of the new administration. Is there some strategizing going on around that?
Joe, that's a good question. Green for All, as some people on this call may know, is a original founding partner of the One Sky campaign, which SACE is a part of. And we have certainly supported the efforts at a base level as we've moved through the 110th Congress. I do not know directly how SACE is engaging and how SACE is going to urge its allies to engage, but one of the things we strongly supported was the funding of the Green Jobs Act. There was actually a piece of legislation included within the 2007 energy bill that called for a Green Jobs Corps, but it is not funded. So, I mean, right now it's, you know, a paper tiger. There's words on paper that aren't going to necessarily get you anywhere. And so I know SACE, for one, would certainly encourage, you know, actually putting some administrative support and muscle behind that. And then beyond that, I don't know specifically, but I would urge and encourage people to be aware of the Green for All organization and movement and look at that, because, as you said, Joe, that is clearly the frame and the reference for how we think some significant pieces of climate and energy legislation are going to move through green jobs and through the green collar economy.
Hey, Jim, this is Veronica in North Carolina. I'm the One Sky North Carolina organizer here, and we are reviewing our campaign plan for the first 100 days, and there are some coordination with Green for All pieces in there. It's definitely not final yet, but those of you who are involved in One Sky, you will be seeing more collaborative efforts like we did this past September. There was also a report that I just received today that folks who are interested can contact One Sky on green jobs. It was a report put out with One Sky and Green for All on how we can move towards a green economy. So I think you can, and I'm happy to talk to folks more in depth, or you can go to the One Sky website to get more information on that.
Yeah, thank you for that, Veronica. Any other questions? We are getting close to the top of the hour, but I don't want to cut it off if we have anybody else.
Yeah, this is Rhonda from Sing down in South Florida. We're working on putting together a strong petition document to, as we have a governor who's so interested in the climate down here, and part of our strategy is to have our renewables roundtable this coming Friday in Miami. If it's possible that other states might do the same thing in urging for a strong renewable portfolio standard in their state, and would be interested in contributing language to that that might make it useful for the region, we would welcome that. Or if anybody has any specific advice right now for us, that would be wonderful too.
Great. Thank you for letting us know about that. Does anybody from another state here want to comment? Obviously, North Carolina does have a state portfolio standard.
This is Veronica in North Carolina again, and I'm happy to put you in touch with folks who worked on that here to get it passed. I'm definitely not an expert on that, but if you would like to send me an email or give me a call offline, I'm happy to get in touch with some folks here.
That would be great. Thank you.
I just want to remind everybody here as we're wrapping up, this call has been recorded. It is still being recorded until I turn that function off, and it will be sent out, the recording with the PowerPoint, and, you know, you are welcome to share it with colleagues and go back to it as reference. I don't know when or if it will be on our website, but I know it will be possible to share. We are in the process of converting cleanenergy.org. We'll be having a very new facelift here quite soon. So we will be able to get that out, and we do encourage you to share it. And then if anybody on this call needs help connecting with anybody else on this call, you know, please feel free to contact either Colin or myself. And we have an attendees list and can help hook you up from state to state. Any other questions, concerns, comments?
Sorry, this is Jesse from Fuse. Just a quick question, and I might have missed this. I had to get up for 2 seconds, so tell me if it's a repetition. In terms of Governor Crist's a climate action plan, I'm starting to read through it. In terms of supporting the whole thing or parts of it, is that something that, and I'm guessing it is, that SACE is going to be, you know, obviously looking through and helping us to either support the whole thing or parts of it in when we're doing advocacy in our events?
You know, I am going to have to ask one of my colleagues if they are better informed on this to comment. I do not track as closely at our state level. I do believe we are, I mean, we are, of course, supporting the climate action and supporting the steps that the governor is taking, whether we are supporting it line item. I do not know. Colin or Tony, would you be able to comment on that?
And this is Melissa.
Melissa, yay.
Hey, Melissa.
Yay, Melissa.
Sorry, I just got back from the doctors. I'll be honest with you, I haven't read through it line by line, but I think generally we're supportive of the direction that it takes because it pretty closely mirrors the governor's executive orders, which we are very supportive of. However, I do believe there's some stuff in there related to nuclear power, and as a rule, you know, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is not supportive of the expansion of nuclear power in the Southeast. So that's the quick question, but I got to be honest, I haven't fully read through it. So I don't know many other specifics.
Okay, thanks.
This is Rhonda from Florida again, too. Hi, Melissa. We are very leery of the amount of reliance that the state is placing on new nuclear and that it will consume all of the money available and also flood the grid with power such that under current regulations, the state won't have, the Public Service Commission will not have the power to approve new sources of generation, whether they be dirty or clean, if the new nuclear installations actually go in. So that's one of the thrusts of getting a truly clean and strong renewable portfolio standard in the state. And the danger here, as it I think it has been in South Carolina, is that they want to put nuclear within the definition of their RPS or rename the RPS to something else that would include nuclear.
Yeah, you are right about that. I know there are several on the phone here in South Carolina that could comment more than I, but the idea of actually rewriting it so that it is almost more of an alternative energy standard rather than a renewable energy standard, and that is a concern. That should be a concern at the federal level as well. We need to be mindful.
Correct. And in Florida, because we have such an amazing capability to harness the power of the sun, thermal and PV, given the way our population is distributed and given the weather patterns here, we and with the governor having such an emphasis on the climate, we could set an incredible precedent nationwide, hopefully.
Right. Can I just ask a follow-up in terms of in Florida or South Carolina or any other state, I had heard in Florida that nuclear by the PSC was rejected as a renewable. Is there any state that has accepted it in their definition of renewable or alternative, and what's the status of that, or rejected it in that?
This is Rhonda. The Public Service Commission hasn't rejected it. They're going to have another meeting on December 3rd and then a final vote supposedly on January 9th. And even then, we're not sure they're going to make a decision, but they have not. They're leaning toward modifying the definition and possibly changing the word to alternative. So it hasn't been outright rejected yet.
And I'll add to that. I do believe that, and I don't know if it's either South Carolina or North Carolina, where they did get nuclear to qualify as a renewable, which is a horrible crime. But basically, they argued that there are some elements of uranium that can be found in seaweed. Therefore, nuclear is a renewable. However, we maintain nuclear is not, nor ever will be, a renewable. I'm hoping that the Public Service Commission will stay strong on denying request for nuclear to be included as a renewable, but I think we'll be in for a fight this legislative session because I think a lot of legislators are very supportive of nuclear power and basically doing anything they can to push it through. The problem is there's already so much, and I think Rhonda and others would agree, there's already so many incentives out there for nuclear power, and there really aren't enough for clean energy. And so if it becomes tainted by including nuclear power and changing it from a renewable portfolio standard to a clean portfolio standard, which is what some people have talked about, it sort of sucks all of the oxygen out of the room for the good energy technologies, the things that we really do need to create a market for solar, wind, ocean energy, biomass, all of that. And so, yes, that did happen, I believe, is either North Carolina or South Carolina. I forget exactly which one. Is there anyone on the call who knows that?
Yes, this is Colin. In South Carolina, the General Assembly initially rejected the claim that nuclear power is somehow renewable. But like you said, Melissa, many are beginning to make that argument, the seaweed containing uranium argument. And so it is beginning to creep up again, although I'm not sure that argument has been officially accepted by the state legislature here in South Carolina. And I understand that there is another state in the Northeast, and I forget exactly which one, and it may be something like Pennsylvania or something like that, where they're beginning to have that issue as well of nuclear being purported to be a renewable energy source. So, as always, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy will be keeping an eye on that here in the Southeast. And, you know, we hope that it certainly does not become a trend nationally. We'll also be keeping an eye on it as it relates to the federal renewable energy standard. And at this point, we haven't heard anything relating to whether or not they will budge on the nuclear renewable question. So if there aren't any other questions or any other burning comments, we will bring this webinar to a close. Is there anyone who would like to make a final statement or ask a last question here?
And I just wanted to say this was a very good conversation here towards the end. It definitely did veer more into state policy, but that's great, and the state and federal policy definitely go hand in hand, and I would absolutely recommend that if people want to continue these conversations at a regional level, you know, to please get in touch with us. Anything specifically about Florida, we would urge and encourage you to contact Melissa Meehan-Baldwin here at SACE, and we can certainly help connect that, because these are good conversations and we don't want to lose these threads, but given that it's 1 o'clock, we want to be respectful of everybody's time. And thank you so very much. I believe, Colin, that we will be sending out, there will be somebody contacting you through email to do an evaluation, I think, of a webinar or something like that. So.
Yep, absolutely. And so, you know, this will conclude our November webinar. And this is actually the third in our monthly series. And we hope you'll join us next month. We'll have details about that one coming up soon to members and supporters.
Thank you to both of you, Colin and Jen.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for joining us. And like Jen said, you know, your feedback is very important to us. And so we will be conducting a webinar survey that we hope you'll participate in. So thanks again for your questions and for joining us. We appreciate your support and look forward to hearing from you soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all.
Bye.
All right, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Bye.